based on unsolved mysteries. A desolate road, a teenage girl driving alone, and one fatal bullet. Under hypnosis, a witness may have described her killer. Guests at a Southern Inn get something extra with the price of their rooms. Ghosts of former residents who died of foul play. He's brutal, cunning, and responsible for 10 murders and 50 rapes. Authorities need your help to catch him. Is Earth on a doomsday collision course with a deadly asteroid? It's happened before, and it will happen again. Cunning, deceit, and lies. Maybe you can guess who's telling the truth. I'm Dennis Farina, and this is Unsolved Mysteries. Valdez, North Carolina. On the night of December 22nd, a recent high school graduate, Rhonda Hinson, attends her first ever company Christmas party. At midnight, Rhonda leaves with two girlfriends. After dropping off her companions, Rhonda plans to make the 10-mile drive to her home, where she lives with her parents. At exactly 1 a.m., Rhonda's mother wakes up from a sound sleep with a strange premonition.
I woke up feeling panicky, scared, because I felt like something had happened to Rhonda. I felt like Rhonda was dead. I felt like she had been in an automobile accident.
I got up and I had a little old CB scanner that you listen to, you know, accidents and all that stuff on it. And for some odd reason, I just turned it on, thought maybe, if it'd been an accident, I'd hear on the scanner. And the minute I turned it on, it came over it, that there'd been a homicide.
120 check, a vehicle in the ditch, foot of Mineral Springs Mountain at I-40. Complainant reports blood in the front seat of same.
Rhonda's car was discovered just a half a mile from her house. The driver's door was open, and a few feet away, Rhonda was found dead. She was lying on her back, and her arms appeared to have been deliberately placed at her side. She had been killed by a single bullet fired by a high-powered rifle. It tore through the trunk of her car, through her seat, and penetrated her heart.
The hardest thing is living every day wondering who did this. Rhonda was the most loving, caring person that you've ever known. Rhonda was the type of daughter that everybody would like to have.
At first, the murder of Rhonda Hinson appeared to be a random act of violence. But as the investigation unfolded, disturbing clues emerged, suggesting that Rhonda may have been murdered by someone she knew. Several weeks after Rhonda's graduation, she began to act strangely. Previously happy to drive alone, she started asking her father to go with her on trips into town. And on one of these trips, she made a disturbing statement.
Dad, I've got something to tell you, but I'm afraid to.
I said, no matter whether it's good or bad, tell me. And she said, I'll think about it. And she never did explain, never did tell me why, what it was, she's afraid to tell me.
Well, you keep your mind on your job, okay?
Her mother also recalled a strange conversation shortly before Rhonda's death.
I was wondering if it's ever okay to go with a married man.
I said, Rhonda, there's never a time that it's all right to go with a married man. The only thing that comes from that is people getting hurt.
Rhonda's comments suggested that she was under some kind of personal pressure. The police investigation began to uncover evidence that someone may have been stalking her the night that she was killed.
between 12:15 and 12:30 on the morning that Rhonda Henson was murdered, a witness drove under the Interstate 40 bridge on Mineral Springs Mountain Road. She observed a blue Chevrolet facing in a northerly direction with two white males in the vehicle.
The car was parked next to the same off-ramp that Rhonda used to exit. It was spotted 30 minutes before the fatal bullet was fired, and just 200 yards from where her body was found. Later that evening, another witness traveling down the same road passed a similar blue car with a single man at the wheel speeding away from the murder site. As he continued down the road, the witness saw Rhonda's vehicle parked at the same spot where her body was found. A woman was slumped over the steering wheel and a man was standing at her door. The witness did not get a close look at the man and drove on, assuming the couple had been drinking.
There were some latent prints on the driver's door, but these latent prints have not been identified.
Police put the witness under hypnosis and asked them to recall more details. This is the actual audio tape of that session.
That Chevelle looks blue.
70 model, I believe.
Looks like the front end has been messed up. It's in primer. The primer's gray. He's not a big guy. He's a 6'5", 10". He's about medium build. So, a dark brown-headed guy.
The witness also remembered seeing a second car parked down the road from Rhonda's vehicle. It was a black or dark blue Trans Am. Some believe that car may have been driven by the murderer. Who killed Rhonda Henson and why? Authorities are certain that she would never have stopped for a stranger. Was Rhonda pulled over by someone she knew, who then fired the fatal shot? Was the man seen at Rhonda's car the murderer, or was he someone who happened by and then left the area when he saw that Rhonda was dead?
We have some different stories, but to really be able to substantiate these stories, we don't have that information. That's what we're looking for, those little pieces of information that we can substantiate what happened.
3T51, Roger.
A $20,000 reward is being offered in this case. If you have any information, please log on to our website at unsolved.com. Next, a 200-year-old mansion is now a hotel where ghosts are as common as guests. In St. Francisville, Louisiana, sits the Myrtles Plantation, a 200-year-old mansion that's been converted into a bed and breakfast. It claims to be one of America's most haunted houses. Shooting, poisoning, and lynching. At least 8 people have died violent deaths here, and some say their spirits are still on the property.
I've had enough happen to let me know that other people live here that we can't always see.
Legend has it that in 1796, the original owner, General David Bradford, built the house directly on top of an Indian burial ground. Since then, hundreds of ghostly sightings have occurred. Could it be that spirits are haunting the plantation? The Myrtles Plantation is said to be a window into the supernatural. Guests here know their stay might include a ghostly encounter.
I guess I have to say I really didn't believe that there were actually ghosts or spirits there, that it was just folklore and legend. And it wasn't until I was already in that things began to happen that convinced me that, yes, they are here. But by then it was too late. Financially, I couldn't afford to be scared.
When Amy Campbell and her friend Michelle came to stay at the B&B one October, they were well informed of its ghostly past.
We were very hesitant if we were going to stay all night because we had heard that the place was haunted. We had heard that there were ghosts that visit people at night, that tuck you in, fix your clothes. We weren't sure we wanted to experience any of that. I was sleeping for a little while and I woke up feeling bouncing on the end of my bed. And I saw a little girl jumping on the end of my bed. And I thought, surely I'm dreaming, and I stuck my head back under the covers. It kept bouncing and bouncing and bouncing. It felt like forever. And all of a sudden it stopped. And I looked back up at the little girl that was jumping on the bed was gone.
The child ghost is thought to be Cornelia Woodruff, one of four people who died in a series of tragic events 175 years ago. Cornelia was the daughter of Judge Woodruff, whose family lived at the Myrtles in the early 1800s. When the Woodruff's house slave, Chloe, was caught eavesdropping on the judge, he decided to punish her.
This is the third time I've caught you.
I wasn't listening.
I will not tolerate this.
Oh, sir, please, no.
The judge ordered Chloe's ear cut off. Afraid of also being sent to the fields to do hard labor, she devised a plan. She ground poisonous oleander leaves into a birthday cake, hoping to make the family sick. And then she would redeem herself by nursing them back to health.
I baked your favorite cake, Miss Sarah.
She may have thought she was boiling just enough oleander to make the family sick. Already knowing what was wrong, she would take care of them, be the hero, and be left in the household to take care of them.
But Chloe's scheme backfired. Young Cornelia, her mother and sister, all died from the poison.
A lot of guests want to know what happened to Chloe after the poisoning. It's believed that she was killed by a mixed mob. Black and whites were probably together. Of course, the other slaves were probably afraid of what was going to happen to them. She was supposedly beaten, hung, and then thrown into the river.
It's believed that Cornelia, along with her mother and sister, has joined Chloe in haunting the house. Several years ago, Mark and Holly Parenti spent a frightening night at the Myrtles. Mark had been reluctant to visit, but knew that his wife would be intrigued by the hotel's history.
It's known as one of the most haunted plantations in America, and I wasn't looking forward to finding out why.
Come right up. It is, it's a beautiful house.
It was scary. The thought of being in this haunted house was very scary, more probably to Mark than me, but I was scared too.
Perhaps Mark and Holly had reason to be nervous. Another of the resident ghosts, a former owner named William Winters, was supposedly gunned down during the late 1800s. He is said to haunt the main staircase. Mark and Holly's room was just beyond that flight of stairs.
My mind had gotten to me a little bit because I wouldn't let her turn the lights off. So we're laying in bed and she's sort of having a nervous chit-chat, and what I heard was a very deep-sounding bang.
Sounds like someone's on the steps.
As soon as I heard that noise, you know, the adrenaline rush.
No, no, Holly, stay here.
Oh, come on.
No.
I want to look.
If I had to venture a guess, it sounded like footsteps.
The reason William Winters was murdered remains a mystery.
William Winters!
It was late one night in 1871 when a mysterious horseman appeared on the Myrtles' front lawn.
Who's there? Are you William Winters?
Yes, I'm William Winters.
Whoever was there shot him in the chest. He made it back through the double doors, trying to reach his wife, Sarah. She was upstairs.
Sarah! Sarah!
He only made it to the 17th step. He died there in her arms.
All I know was that it was enough for me. You know, it was enough for me to make me want to leave.
In a way, I think we were both hoping it might have been our imagination, but it definitely wasn't.
There are certain times that I'm uncomfortable here. Certain times that, you could say I get the creeps. You can feel a sadness, or you can walk in and you hear, especially upstairs, footsteps. You know you hear them. Someone is right behind you. You can stop. The footsteps stop.
Once you have the encounter and you feel the sensation, you will know that their intention is not to harm you. They are truly here to protect you. They protect this home. This is their station. This is their life. This is where they live.
Next, a series of brutal rapes stretches across 400 miles, and a DNA match links them to the same suspect. Sacramento, California.
I remember waking up with a flashlight shining in my face.
Sailor.
And I was looking down the barrel of a gun, and he said, don't move, don't make a sound, or I will kill you.
Give me your hands.
And within a moment's notice, my life was all of a sudden in the control of somebody else.
Just do as I tell you.
This rape victim, whose identity we are not revealing at her request, is one of more than 50 women believed to have been assaulted by a serial rapist who terrorized the Sacramento area during the 1970s.
The mysterious attacker, known as the East Area Rapist, has never been identified. Now, advances in law enforcement technology have linked him to a series of murders that happened a decade earlier. Authorities need your help to track down this very cunning and very dangerous criminal.
The East Area Rapist displayed some unusual habits, including lingering in the victim's homes for hours.
I know that at some point he was out in the living room smoking, and the police felt that he maybe had gotten into my refrigerator. I think he was in the house anywhere from 2.5 to 3 hours. I lay there for what seemed like a long period of time with no noise. And then all of a sudden, I couldn't see, I couldn't move, and I couldn't yell. And I remember wondering, is this it? Is this the way I'm gonna die?
After sexually assaulting his victims, the rapist would quietly sneak away.
Can you tell me maybe a little of what he looked like, maybe how tall he was?
The East Area Rapist very definitely did a psychological rape along with the physical rape. In the manner in which he would threaten the victims, the length of time that he stayed in the home, his crime was different and unique.
The first 15 attacks occurred in houses where only women and children were at home. But then the rapist began targeting homes in which a man was also present.
When the rapist would come in, he would, at gunpoint, order the female to tie up the male in the house. And then he would remove the female to the other part of the house where he would also tie her up. And then he would put the dishes on the husband.
If I hear one plate rattle, I'll kill everyone in the house.
While he was in the other room occupied with the sexual assault, he could hear whether or not the male was trying to get free. There was so much fear in the community, so we were holding town hall meetings.
We understand your concern.
They were incensed to think that a man could have been in the home when these rapes occurred and not have done anything about it.
I think that he liked the excitement of the game,
I think it was as much a game with the investigators as it was for what he was doing to the victims.
The rapist's sadistic game sometimes extended beyond the attack itself.
Hello.
Several victims reported getting disturbing phone calls from the rapist years later.
Who is this?
I felt by what he said to me that he had been still watching me and stalking me. I felt absolutely terrified. I think the phone calls were just his way of saying, you're still my hostage. Even though I'm not in your house, psychologically, you're still my hostage.
Police believe that this recording, made by one of the victims, is the actual voice of the rapist. By the late 1970s, the East Area Rapist had apparently moved 50 miles to Contra Costa County. Five more assaults were reported there. Then the attacks abruptly stopped.
And everybody speculated on where this guy might have gone and why he might have stopped. And there was nowhere to go with it. We had no real physical description.
The trail grew cold. But over the years, criminalist Paul Holes continued to work the case. He ran DNA profiles on semen recovered from the five rapes in his county. And then he tried to track down the rapist. Holes began contacting agencies across the state. 400 miles south in Orange County, forensic scientist Mary Hong had used DNA to link six rape murders in her county to a single killer. In 2001, Mary got a call from Paul Holes.
Let me grab that file.
Independently, he was thinking that this guy has to be committing these crimes somewhere else. So he actually was calling these agencies and finding out if they had any cases that fit his profile.
Okay, I've got D3, 15, 16.
I had him read me the profile that he had on his case.
Okay.
And I compared that to the profile that I had in our cases, and they matched all the way across.
Wow, looks like we've got a match. At that point, we knew that we had just connected the series of sexual assaults in Northern California with a series of homicides down in Southern California.
In Southern California during the 1980s, the East Area Rapist began murdering his rape victims and their partners. He was the suspect in 10 such killings.
I don't know of anyone like him. He's a very unique offender. 50 rapes that we're aware of, 10 murders that we're aware of. We suspect that he's probably responsible for more rapes and murders and crimes outside of what we've identified.
Police think a clue to the attacker's identity might be found in his habit of stacking plates on the victim's partner during the assault.
It's a signature aspect of our offender. Is it possible that someone abused him and treated him the same way? Terrorizing him, perhaps, as a boy when he grew up, it's possible.
Somebody out there has to know something about this person. And if the information could come forward, will it ever bring closure to the victims? Only that they would feel safe that he is not out there to attack again.
I don't want to end my career without having solved this. And if it's not solved by the time I retire, I'll think about it till the day I die.
Update. There are new developments in this case. Here's one of our staff with details.
A suspect in the case of the East Area Rapist, now popularly known as the Golden State Killer, was arrested. More than 40 years after the initial crimes, Joseph James DeAngelo admitted to committing more than a dozen murders. He pleaded guilty to 26 charges and was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Next,
Is planet Earth on a collision course with a deadly asteroid? Imagine the entire country devastated in less than a minute. A large city wiped off the map in a matter of seconds. A nuclear nightmare? No. A natural disaster unlike anything in human history. And it will come from outer space. July 16th, 1994. A frightening preview. The most powerful chain of explosions ever witnessed by scientists. They began when huge fragments of a giant comet called Shoemaker-Levy slammed into the planet Jupiter.
Well, out of this series of fragments, there were actually 15 that survived that we saw hit the planet. And of those, about four or five were the big ones. When each of those largest fragments hit Jupiter, it had about the same energy as if you had taken all of the nuclear bombs in the world.
Dr. Gene Shoemaker is co-discoverer of the Shoemaker-Levy comet.
Put them all in one big pile and set them off all at once. That's about 10,000 million tons of energy.
One of the explosions created a cloud of debris as large as the Earth. If it happened there, can it happen here?
Large collisions like Shoemaker-Levy occur only once every 100 million years. But we're not entirely safe. There are thousands of asteroids and comets streaking through our solar system. Is it possible that one could collide with our planet? Well, in fact, it's already happened, and more than once.
40 miles east of Flagstaff, Arizona, is Meteor Crater. Long before the dawn of civilization, a massive asteroid slammed into the desert floor. Scientists estimate its velocity at more than 40,000 miles per hour.
Meteor Crater is the first recognized impact crater on the Earth. It's 4,000 feet across, about 600 feet deep. It was formed by an iron asteroid about 50 yards in diameter. And it was formed very close to 50,000 years ago. But if you had been there, you wouldn't want to have been too close. If you had been standing where Flagstaff is today, 40 miles away, you would have probably been knocked over by the shockwave. Buildings would have been collapsed.
Large meteors striking the Earth aren't just ancient history. In 1908, a fireball raced through the sky over Siberia. It exploded above the remote area of Tunguska, spraying debris with the force of 1,000 atomic bombs.
To get a good idea of the devastating effect of this impact event, a city that I know very well, Houston, has surrounding it a highway, a beltway highway, 610 loop. Everything inside the 610 loop would have been flattened and charred. All the buildings, all the infrastructure, nothing would have been standing inside that area. Anyone who lived there would have been dead.
Such devastation did occur on a worldwide scale at least once in the history of our planet. It was 65 million years ago, during the age of the dinosaur. A giant meteor, 5 miles across, plowed into Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, where the small town of Chicxulub now stands.
The surface expression would not lead you to believe that there is an impact crater there. You have a nice flat Yucatan Peninsula with really no topographic signs that a crater 180 to 200 miles across exists below.
So what would it be like to witness such a cataclysmic event?
Well, immediately before the impact, we think you would see a comet. Keep in mind that this object is traveling at about 140,000 miles per hour. You don't have a lot of time between the time it goes into the atmosphere and the time that it actually strikes the Earth. Much less than a second, obviously.
The impact at Chicxulub was heard and felt in every corner of the Earth. The ground surged upward. tons of rock and dust formed a massive curtain, hundreds of miles across and hundreds of miles high.
As this dust started to make its way into the atmosphere, it would block the sunlight completely. It would be as dark as night. As some of this material started to re-enter the atmosphere, however, things would begin to light up, not by the illumination of the sun, but by the illumination of countless meteorites, shooting stars streaking through the upper atmosphere.
These balls of fire ignited a raging inferno that spread across the entire Western Hemisphere. The smoke joined with the impact debris and covered the Earth with a suffocating cloud. For at least a year, there was no sunlight, triggering a new ice age. Roughly 75% of Earth's plant and animal life died. The most well-known victim was the dinosaur.
The consensus is today that dinosaurs were doing very nicely up until this event, and immediately after this event, they were gone, and they never came back.
According to NASA, more than 5,000 asteroids can be classified as near Earth. Of those, nearly 1,000 are considered potentially dangerous for the planet. In 2004, scientists discovered a new asteroid named Apophis, a chunk of interplanetary rock between 700 and 1,000 feet across. Although it's too soon to know for sure, there's a small chance this near-Earth object will eventually collide with our planet. The date? April 13th, 2036.
The hazard of impact in terms of loss of life on the Earth, you don't take out just 100,000 lives lost. You could wipe out half or more of the entire human population.
If an event similar to the one that formed Chicxulub happened tomorrow, then there would be no civilization. There is no doubt about that. There would be widespread devastation, death like we have never even imagined. And there's no protection for it. It's just one of those things that we have to live with. Fortunately, however, events like Chicxulub are extremely rare.
Next, the amazing encounter of identical strangers who may be long-lost relatives. And later, a horrific accident leads to a rescue by a mysterious Good Samaritan. In December of 1943, Ken Palmer was a second lieutenant in the Army Air Corps. He was traveling from Texas to Wisconsin. During a change of trains, he had the most remarkable encounter of his life. Ken had the feeling that someone was staring at him, and then he saw why. He was being watched by his exact double.
I was amazed. And both of us saw it, and both of us reacted so much to it. Both of us set down our bags and stared. And until I got hold of myself and extended my hand, he didn't move. He was just frozen, looking at himself in a different uniform.
I'm Ken Palmer. My name is Palmer.
My first thought, of course, was that he's closely related. We began to exchange our father's names, our grandfather's names, where we lived, things of this nature. And that didn't get it.
My grandfather's from Brownsville.
The two men couldn't find a single relative in common. But when Ken mentioned an old family legend, he was stunned by the stranger's response.
My family often talks of this lost treasure in India. Two Palmer brothers were at a party in the Court of St. James. Yeah. They cut the queue off a court official. Yeah, that's right. They had to flee England. I mean, that's the story. Left a fortune.
Well, not alone did he know about it, he added details that I checked out with Dad later, and they were accurate. Things that I didn't know. So it was perfectly obvious that we were related, and yet we couldn't understand how we could be.
You write down your name and address. When I get back home, I'm going to contact you.
I took his name and address, stuffed it in my pocket.
I'll write you. Goodbye. Goodbye.
I picked up my luggage and scooted off for my train. If I'd had the sense that God gave geese, I would have stopped right then, and we would have spent some time together. When I got on the train and settled, I reached in my pocket to get that slip of paper. It wasn't there. It all fell apart at that moment. I was devastated.
Ken never saw his double again, and all attempts to find him have been unsuccessful. These pictures of Ken Palmer were taken in the 1940s. The man he met looked virtually identical. Like Ken, his last name was Palmer. His first name may have been Robert or James.
I would like very much to find him and or part of his family. How many times are you going to walk across the station and see that double? Out of all of the people in the United States, we walk into one another and we set down our bags and stare at one another. Magical moment.
Ken believes that his double lived in the eastern United States, possibly New Jersey. At the time, the man was either a technical or staff sergeant in the Army Air Corps. If you have any information that could help clear up this case, please log on to our website at unsolved.com. Ocala, Florida. 48-year-old Wilma Drew was just a mile from home. She had driven up this hill hundreds of times. But a few miles away, a car had entered the highway going the wrong direction. It was headed straight for Wilma at 55 miles an hour. David Vitato was driving right behind Wilma.
As we were approaching the crest, I saw headlights approaching us. And the minute the lights came into view, I immediately tried to get over in the right-hand lane to avoid the collision. I automatically, just in my gut, knew that somebody was going to be dead.
David stopped to help. The driver and passenger in the wrong way car seemed to be moving, but Wilma was not. She was pinned in her car, the steering column wedged up against her chest. The driver's window was open, but the other windows and all the doors were jammed.
Go out to my truck, I'll get a tour.
I decided to run back to the truck to grab a tire tool, try to pry the door open, or whatever I could do to try to get in to assist her, possibly better.
Ma'am? Another good Samaritan, Matthew White, also stopped to help. The two men didn't know it, but Wilma's neck had been broken, cutting off her air passage. She was suffocating.
All the doors are jammed. Her driver's side window was busted out, and we couldn't break the windows out, so we were trying to get someone who has something that could break the window.
Hey, we need some help!
David tried flagging down help. A tanker truck stopped. Remarkably, the driver seemed to know exactly what to do and how to do it.
Get it open.
All right, stand back.
After I busted the window, he climbed in into the back seat and reached over and lifted and held Wilma's head up.
Wilma took a breath.
Let's get this thing off her. Give her some room. You got it?
Matthew and David struggled to lift the steering column off Wilma's chest.
Come on.
The trucker kept her neck motionless. The ambulance arrived 10 minutes later.
Okay, sir, I need you to let go and come out of the car, okay?
I'm not letting go until you put a brace around her neck.
To get out of the car.
And the paramedic was just insistent that he let go of her head and get out of the car. And the man would not let go of her head until I held it while he got out and the paramedic got in.
You got her?
Yeah.
You got her gently?
Yeah, I got her.
Wilma was stabilized. But during the confusion, no one saw the truck driver leave. No one had a chance to get more than a glimpse of what he looked like. Wilma's husband came upon the crash scene a short time later.
When I saw the vehicle, in my mind, nobody could have lived through it. I remember a lady asked me if that was my car, and I said, yes, and my wife's dead. And she says, no, she isn't. They just, you know, left here where they're in the helicopter.
It took 11 operations and almost a year to begin to repair the damage. Wilma's right leg had been nearly torn in half. Her left ankle was shattered. Her brainstem was so damaged that it caused permanent double vision. And one of the vertebrae in Wilma's neck was completely severed.
The neurosurgeon told us he's never seen anybody survive that injury, and he can't understand why she's still alive. And that was kind of eerie.
I don't know why it happened to me, but I know that there is a purpose for it, and it's even peculiar that I've never experienced any anger. I'm just very thankful to be alive.
Is she breathing?
Yeah.
The neurosurgeon said he did it exactly right. Had he done it any different, it wouldn't have worked. He gave the doctor something to work with, and he just saved her life and gave her back to us.
Thank you just really seems so insignificant as far as the way we feel that someone would take the time to get involved and to do all he did for me and then just disappear.
Update. After seeing himself portrayed on Unsolved Mysteries, the truck driver contacted our phone center. We put him in touch with Wilma. He explained that he used to be an EMT, and that's why he just knew what to do when he came upon the scene. 3 years after her accident, Wilma was finally able to thank the man who had saved her life. He was thrilled to hear that she had survived the accident.